loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner is in the Middle East leading a high-profile delegation, they say, with the aim of restarting Palestinian-Israeli talks. Thousands gathered outside to protest as Donald Trump gave a campaign-style speech last night in Phoenix, Arizona, where he doubled down on the far-right rhetoric that has caused widespread outrage in the wake of the white supremacist terrorist attack in Charlottesville, Virginia. Angela Merkel is publicly distancing herself from Donald Trump's ultra-aggressive position on North Korea. Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian companies were sanctioned by the United States for their alleged business connections with North Korea. But first, we turn to Donald Trump's advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner's trip to the Middle East, leading a high-profile delegation there with the aim of, they say, restarting Palestinian-Israeli talks. But is this just a way to stall and buy time for the Israeli occupation strategy? We are joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-founder of the news outlet The Electronic Intifada and the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine and also One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Welcome, Ali.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Anyway, the big news today was there wasn't going to be a meeting in Egypt, and there was going to be a meeting in Egypt. The U.S. decided to delay some money, $96 million and then $195 million to the Egyptian government. But at long last, of course, Kushner met with the Egyptian foreign minister and with al-Sisi. Just big picture here, what's your take on all of this? What's the purpose of the trip?
Well, the headline is that it's supposed to encourage Middle East peace or at least to explore ways to restart the so-called peace process. But, you know, that is so far removed from any remote reality that, you know, it's hard to know what it is, if it's just a junket for Jared Kushner to keep him out of the White House or if it's, you know, just to feed Trump's delusion that he's going to be the president who, you know, makes this incredible deal because, you know, peace in the Middle East is so much easier than anyone thought. It's hard to see any coherence. I mean, even on the issue of aid to the Egyptian dictatorship, Obama famously refused to call Sisi's military coup a military coup so that the aid could continue to flow, the military aid to Egypt. Trump also warmly embraced Sisi and endorsed him in terms much warmer than Obama even. And then you see them now delaying or suspending this U.S. military aid. So the policies are incoherent and seem to change from one day to the next. And you don't know who's in charge. Is it the White House? Is it the State Department? Who knows?
Let's hear a short audio clip from Donald Trump. This was back in April, when he gave a joint press statement alongside Egyptian President Sisi. Let's listen to that, and then I'll get your reaction because it's in the same vein.
It's great to be with the President of Egypt, and I will tell you, President al-Sisi has been somebody that's been very close to me from the first time I met him. I met during the campaign, and at that point there were two of us, and we both met. And hopefully you like me a lot more. But it was a very long, it was supposed to be just a quick, brief meeting, and we were with each other for a long period of time. We agree on so many things. I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, that we are very much behind President al-Sisi, who's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation.
All right, so there you have Trump in April really embracing al-Sisi. Now, again, as you mentioned, Ali, the incoherence, the United States says it's decided to deny Egypt $96 million in aid and delay a further $195 million because of its, quote, failure to make progress on respecting human rights and democratic norms. Well, that didn't somehow start since April when Trump made those statements. Where do you think Trump is as a person? Or is it impossible to actually talk like that about Trump?
I mean, then we get into all the stuff that people are talking about. But I think the reality is that, Trump is detached from reality. But the United States is a big country and a big bureaucracy. And we have, a military state, a deep state, whatever you want to call it, a military political establishment that is doing the things it wants to do. And we saw that most dramatically with Trump's capitulation to what the generals want in Afghanistan, which is to continue the 16-year-old American war indefinitely with no end in sight, no possibility of the victory that Donald Trump keeps demanding. And, one of the few good things Trump might have done would be to end the war in Afghanistan. It seems self-evident to a lot of people that, the wars create the terrorism. And therefore, more war is going to create more terrorism. And, after how many years, 16 years of so-called war on terror, the great so-called American intelligence community can't seem to figure out that simple self-evident truth. And so Trump has capitulated to them and their longstanding demands of the generals to continue the war. So there is an American state and establishment that continues with the same imperial policies no matter who the clown or the demon or the suave operator who's in the White House.
Indeed. And since Sadat, who is the leader of Egypt following Nasser, and since the Camp David summit and the Camp David agreement in 1979 that essentially took Egypt, the largest Arab country and the largest Arab army, out of the equation of confrontation with the state of Israel and had a separate peace, that regime has gone on no matter what. And even after Mubarak was toppled, and even after we had a Muslim Brotherhood government, and after al-Sisi toppled it through a military coup d'etat, that sort of architecture of the relationship U.S., Egypt, Israel, it's basically the same. In other words, all of these figures, now Trump too, or Jared Kushner too, they come and go, but the essential architecture remains in place. From the point of view of the people of Egypt and the Egyptian sort of ruling circle, if one can call it that, what do they get out of this kind of relationship?
Well, what they get is that, there is a small, very wealthy ruling elite in Egypt, which has been plundering the country for decades. And that plunder, accelerated on steroids from the time of Sadat, when Sadat pivoted Egypt into the U.S.-Israeli camp. And they're very happy with the situation where, 80 million people in Egypt are living in poverty. The country is falling apart. The infrastructure is a catastrophe. Basic services don't function. You have this very wealthy elite that controls the economy, along with the military. The military is very much involved in controlling the economy. It owns companies and lands and so on. And this is a cozy relationship that works for them. Remember that when Sisi staged the military coup and there was a question for a brief moment of whether the U.S. would call it a coup and suspend the $1.5 billion in military aid, it was actually the Israel lobby, AIPAC, went to bat for the regime in Egypt and said, basically, the Egyptian regime helps us, so the U.S. should continue with the flow of aid. So dictators come, dictators go, but those things have been constant.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm speaking with Ali Abunima. My name is Brian Becker. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday at 105.5 FM here in the Washington, D.C. area. Ali, I want to talk to you, if you would, about the big picture. You wrote a book. You've written a lot. But this one book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, Talk about what you mean by that, by one country, and is it possible?
Well, I wrote that book, you know, now more than 10 years ago, and I wrote another book a couple of years ago, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And the basic dynamics that I identified was that there isn't going to be a two-state solution. I said that confidently in 2006, and I say it even more confidently now. And this went against the grain of all the conventional wisdom that said, you know, the two-state solution is the only solution. It's the most possible. It's what the so-called international community is pushing for. And what I predicted in my book in 2006 is that Israel would head in an ever more extreme and right-wing direction. And that is exactly what has happened. And at the same time, you'll see the possibility for any kind of rational or humane physical partition disappear. And so effectively, what we have now is what we saw coming, which is effectively a one-state solution, but with a radical Zionist, ultra-nationalist, ultra-Jewish nationalist regime controlling the whole country and becoming ever more violent towards the Palestinian population, which, after all, is 50%, if not more, of the population. And I think that the transformation that has happened internationally that is so interesting and I think is going to be a key factor in the dynamics is that Israel has become more and more identified with the extreme right globally. And Israel has become a cause of the extreme right, of the most Islamophobic, far right, even neo-Nazi elements and regimes around the world identify with Israel and see Israel as their model. And Israel seeks relationships with them. That's true in the U.S., where Israel has become basically the cause of the far right, including the Christian Zionist evangelical right, and in Europe, where, you know, you have Hitler, you know, it's Nazi apologists like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who rehabilitated Viktor Horthy, the wartime ally of Hitler, who oversaw the murder of 500,000 people during the Holocaust, is a great friend of Benjamin Netanyahu. For the same reason, we see this close alliance between, you know, Steve Bannon, who, of course, just left the White House, and Israel. The Israeli ambassador, Ron Dermer, went to bat for Steve Bannon when there was all the criticism of over Trump appointing him. And, of course, notoriously, Netanyahu didn't say anything about Charlottesville. The prime minister of the so-called Jewish state, which is supposed to be eternally vigilant against anti-Semitism, didn't say anything about neo-Nazis marching in the streets of an American city until, you know, 3 days later when the silence became so embarrassing for defenders of Israel. But the point is that, you know, Israel is losing mainstream and progressive opinion all over the West, including in the United States. And that has an impact. It feeds into the politics because it is pushing support for a genuine democratic and egalitarian solution, which is, you know, what I've been talking about for years, a democratic state along the lines of South Africa. You know, you dismantle the system, you leave the people in place, but you dismantle the system and provide rights for everyone and a process of restitution and decolonization. I still think that's the direction it's heading, because where else can it go other than more ethnic cleansing, more genocide? And who could possibly want that?
That was the voice of Ali Abunima. You can read his writings at the website, the news outlet, the Electronic Intifada. He's the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine, and earlier, the book One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali, I couldn't agree with you more. In 2002, I was part of, here in Washington, an anti-war coalition. We were planning a demonstration on the 20th of April. And then at the end of March, Israel reinvaded the West Bank, and there was a big split inside that coalition. I was part of the group that said we should focus the demonstration on Palestine. And as a consequence, the two groups the two sides of the coalition broke up. And on the same day, one side had a demonstration that didn't include Palestine. And the other one, the demonstration I was helping to organize, did. And everybody said in the beginning, oh, your demonstration will be so small because nobody, even from the left at that time, seemed to want to touch the issue of Palestine like it was a taboo. About 75,000 people, though, came out. It was like this unusually large event, maybe the biggest up until that time for Palestinian rights. That was 15 years ago. When you look at the country today, including within the Jewish American community, far from being a taboo, I think more and more progressive people all over the map, all over the place, are embracing the just cause of the Palestinian people, embracing BDS. I mean, those are the kind of sort of sea changes that the Israeli government and the American government, I don't think, really fully anticipated 15 years ago. And I think they're shocked and alarmed by it.
Yeah, and the elites in this country are shocked and alarmed by it, and not least within the Democratic Party, because, you know, this the phenomenon you're describing, people call it progressive against Palestine, people who are willing to take stands on all kinds of issues, to challenge the establishment on all kinds of issues, but not when it came to Israel. And you still see that within the elites of the Democratic Party, where, you know, to a person, they pledge allegiance to, you know, to Israel's policies, no matter what they are practically. But the challenge has come from the base, and that reflects what's happening across the country among young Jewish people, in the population generally, and it's happening in Europe and Canada and Australia too. We've seen recent surveys that show that large pluralities and sometimes majorities in these countries support sanctions or boycott divestment and sanctions on Israel because they understand that this is a legitimate means by which Palestinians can put pressure for their rights. So I think Palestine has often been this kind of bellwether. It really shows you how serious a political leader or a political movement is about being willing to take on the establishment. Are they willing to grasp this issue of Palestine, or are they going to shy away with it? A reliable indicator is that if a political leader is not going to stand up on the question of Palestine, then they're not going to stand up on anything. There is eventually a point at which they will succumb to pressure.
Ali, we have 3 minutes left. Last week, I want to turn back to the trip here, Jared Kushner's trip. He's about to meet with the Israeli political leaders. Last week, Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, the president of the Palestinian Authority, was quoted as saying, quote, I have met with Trump envoys about 20 times since the beginning of his term as president of the United States. Every time they repeatedly stressed to me how much they believe and are committed to a two-state solution and a halt to construction in the settlements. I have pleaded with them to say the same thing to Netanyahu, but they refrained. I can't understand how they are conducting themselves with us. Inside Trump's country, there is chaos in the administration. 2 minutes left, Ali. I mean, talk about Mahmoud Abbas and why he can't understand this.
Well, you couldn't find a more compliant leader for Israel than Mahmoud Abbas. He's basically Israel's quisling in the West Bank, enforcing the occupation hand in hand with Israel. And he's saying he's baffled. So, Abbas is on his way out. He's over 80 years old and a heavy smoker. He's hated by a majority of Palestinians, really has no authority to make any kind of deal. Netanyahu is about to be indicted, it looks like, for corruption. Jared Kushner has no clue what he's doing. Israeli settlers are running wild. You know, the idea that anything is going to come out of this in terms of a peace process is simply delusional. I think that the momentum is shifting towards international solidarity, towards boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And look, you know, governments can dismiss that and say, oh, it's just a bunch of activists. But look at where the money is going. Israel is putting tens of millions of dollars into fighting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement because they understand the political sea change that's going on, and they understand that this has the potential to transform the political landscape to their detriment and to the benefit of those who want to see genuine equal rights and justice and peace for everyone there.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima. He is the co-founder of the news outlet, The Electronic Intifada. Be sure to go to their site for all that's happening in the Middle East. He is also the author of The Battle for Justice in Palestine and a book that came earlier, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Thousands gathered outside to protest as Donald Trump gave a campaign-style speech last night in Phoenix, Arizona, where he doubled down on the far-right rhetoric that has caused widespread outrage in the wake of the white supremacist terrorist attack in Charlottesville. We are joined from New York by Ted Rall, award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks, Brian.
Let's start with an audio clip from last night. Donald Trump speaking, letting loose in Phoenix. Here it is.
In the proud tradition of America's great leaders, from George Washington, please don't take his statue down, please. Please. Does anybody want George Washington's statue? No. Is that sad? Is that halt sad? To Lincoln, to Teddy Roosevelt, I see they want to take Teddy Roosevelt's down too. They're trying to figure out why. They don't know. They're trying to take away our culture. They're trying to take away our history. And our weak leaders, they do it overnight. These things have been there for 150 years, for 100 years. You go back to a university and it's gone. Weak, weak people.
All right, Ted, they're trying to take away our culture.
They're trying to take away the culture of a country that doesn't exist anymore, the Confederacy. He may not quite be aware of the fact that he's the president of the United States of America. So no matter where you stand on these Confederate statues, the fact is that they're not American history at all. They're the history of a country that was defeated in a war and no longer exists anymore. And I think people also tend to conflate history and memorialization. Statues come and go. Statues exist for the glorification of a figure or an idea. And there are times when certainly history and memorialization intersect. For sure, there's a Venn diagram there. But I think it's a valid question to ask in the United States whether and why we should be memorializing over, I believe, 750 statues of Confederate figures, considering the fact that that the symbolism is so undeniably harsh and very, very difficult for African American and other people who were victims of that fallen regime. So it's so wrong on so many levels that it's hard to even know where to start.
Let's talk about what he said last night, because it's Trump. He broke out of the beltway where he's being pummeled constantly. He went to his base. Talk about what he said, why he said it, and what his relative strength is right now with the core base support that he enjoyed that propelled him to the presidency, even though he lost the popular vote. I mean, it was a fired up speech. It was also a redefense, really, of his emotional sort of outburst a week ago Tuesday, where he really showed that his heart was with the white supremacists, some of whom he said were very fine people. Talk about all of that, if you would.
Let's start with your penultimate question about the Republican base. I mean, the reason we are still talking about this man and the reason he's still president of the United States is because the Republican base is still pretty much in his corner. Roughly 80% of registered Republicans continue to strongly support this president. And that's why you're getting even figures like Mitch McConnell, who have privately been confiding that they think that this president is not, this administration is not long for this world, are not able or willing to summon the courage to speak up. He went to Phoenix in order to sort of show in the Trump model of a presidency is really in diametrically opposed to what we've seen in recent American history. Every president that I can think of in my lifetime realized that they had to draw support from the opposite party, from voters from the opposite party, in order to effectively govern. This president has decided to govern the same way that he campaigned, almost the same way he campaigned in the primaries, which is to the far right of the Republican Party. And it's an interesting tactic because although it makes it doubtful that he will be able to finish 4 years as president, it does show that you are that base will continue to love you to death in a way that they wouldn't if you decided to tack more to the center. He clearly has sympathies with the far right that I think go far beyond, go far beyond just political exigency. This is not just mere opportunism of saying, hey, there's votes here. I've got to suck up to these racists. I think this is who he is. And as Anderson Cooper said, he revealed, if there was ever any doubt, who he was. And anyone who chooses not to pay attention to that is willfully not paying attention.
When he was speaking last night, Trump, again, at least, well, strongly hinted at pardoning Sheriff Joe Arpaio, saying, was Sheriff Joe convicted for doing his job? He should have had a jury. I'll make a prediction. I think he's going to be just fine, but I won't do it tonight because I don't want to cause any controversy. He's going to pardon Sheriff Joe, but help the audience understand who Sheriff Joe is and what he did.
Yeah, Sheriff Joe Arpaio was the longtime former sheriff of Maricopa County, which is the county surrounding Phoenix, Arizona. And he became a national figure way back in the 1990s for his hard line on immigration, but it's beyond a hard line. He would round up undocumented workers and send them to tent cities in the Arizona desert where the temperature can easily get up into the 110s and the 120s in the sun. There were people died in those camps of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. He humiliated them by forcing them to wear pink underwear. He even marketed the pink underwear on his website. He marketed himself as America's toughest sheriff and really came into his own during the 9/11 era as sort of a self-styled Old West badass in the George W. Bush in full cowboy mode. I had the misfortune of seeing him speak at a cartoonists convention in Phoenix back in the mid-90s, and I was struck by how this was a man who had absolutely no consideration for, but nothing but contempt for his charges. When prisoners or detainees are held by a law enforcement officer, they have custody over that person. They're responsible for their psychological and mental well-being as well as their physical well-being. But Arpaio, like a true fascist, really just didn't give a damn about that. And honestly, I think America has got a little bit better off when he lost that election last year and did not get reelected as sheriff. But he's still very, very popular on the right. And I agree with you, Trump is almost certainly going to pardon him, which I think is just obscene.
Yeah. And when Trump did that and said that last night, toyed with the audience, they, of course, went wild because they like what Sheriff Joe, the America's toughest sheriff, did. From National Public Radio, I want to read this little clip from something they put up on their website. When he filled up the jail cells, and again, these were not with criminals, they were with people who were undocumented. In other words, people who were at work. He arrested them at work. To avoid hurting his popularity because he had filled up the jails by spending too much of taxpayers' money, he built the tents, as you mentioned, in the middle of the Arizona desert, where temperatures reach up to 130 degrees. He deprived the inmates of basic necessities and reduced the meals to 2 per day while cutting the cost of each meal to 30 cents. He then boasted, quote, it costs us more to feed the dogs rather than the prisoners. Under such conditions, inmates were always hungry and suffered drastic physical repercussions. One teenager reported losing 50 pounds since he was incarcerated. That's who Donald Trump loves. I mean, Sheriff Joe is Donald Trump. I mean, the same sort of mentality.
The man, Sheriff Joe is a monster. He should be in prison. He should be, it's not an original thought, but he should be in one of his own tent, in one of his tent camps as the sole inmate, like Albert Speer was at Spandau Prison. He's a menace to society, and the last thing he deserves is a presidential pardon.
Right. So let's talk about Trump in the media, because last night he was attacking The Washington Post, CNN, New York Times, I mean, really, really attacking them. And the crowd was yelling back and taunting reporters who were present. When you see that, of course, we understand that there is a huge sort of media war against Trump and some media for Trump. But when you see this kind of spectacle from the president of the United States egging on the crowd to taunt and, you know, sort of torment the reporters, what does it make you think of?
It reminds me of the Nuremberg rallies. Those were different. Those had a lot of fake pomp and circumstance. This is Nuremberg meets WWE. Trump is a carnival barker for the far right, and it's terrifying. Honestly, I mean, fascism. When fascism came to or comes to America, it's going to come in uniquely American form. And Donald Trump is marketing this in a very American form. Loud, brash, kind of funny, no doubt extremely entertaining. Don't change the channel. A lot of people who go to those rallies say they may or may not agree with what he has to say, but there's nothing like the show that Donald Trump puts on. And that's very, very true.
Right. So bread and circuses, as the Roman ruling class learned, was somewhat effective. And the funny thing, too, as we've talked about in the past, but I always want to remind the audience, the media that is Donald Trump is attacking, because he is an entertainment value and because he's good for their ratings, they actually made Donald Trump a thing. Donald Trump was an essentially bankrupt real estate, mid-level real estate developer. I mean, nobody took him seriously. A reality show TV guy, you're fired. And the media made everything about him. And now they're acting so sanctimonious, as if this monster, Donald Trump, is taking America to this terrible place. But they made him. I mean, nobody would have voted for Trump if they hadn't given him those 24/7 news coverage. I don't mean after he won the primary, but in the year beforehand.
That's totally true. I think in fairness to the media, there was some hand-wringing and a few mea culpas after the election by some who admitted that they had spilled too much ink on him and had given him too much oxygen, and then they underestimated his ability to win. I think that's right.
It wasn't Sputnik, and even though I love my show, but my show was anti-Trump all the time. And RT, which the U.S. government, the Democratic Party, they say, well, it was the Russian media that somehow manipulated the minds of the American people. But it was the American media. Yes, they turned against him eventually. But because they only cared, as Leslie Moombs said, the executive director the CEO of CBS said, this might be bad for the country, but it's good for CBS. They did this. I mean, it makes me mad that everybody's looking at CNN and looking at the people who are anti-Trump and looking to CNN as if their constant anti-Trump coverage has some sort of new relevance, when in fact they did this.
Yeah, well, when the government got rid of the law, I think you'll know the name of this, the law that required equal time for candidates of both parties to be presented on the air.
Yeah, the Fairness Doctrine.
The Fairness Doctrine. When that went out the window, American politics really started to go off the rails in a serious way, and we've seen that. Donald Trump is the embodiment of that. You know, we just imagine. That happened also within the primaries as well, right? I mean, Trump had what 18 or 19 opponents in the Republican primaries. But, you know, we didn't hear nearly as much from, you know, these other characters like Rick Perry or, you know, Chris Christie and so on, even though many of them were very prominent politicians, governors, senators and so on, well-known figures. Rand Paul didn't get much play, even though at one point he was considered a front runner for the nomination. And then obviously on the Democratic side, I mean, there was a lot of documentation of how Hillary Clinton got a lot more coverage than Bernie Sanders repeatedly. And that was kind of intentional because Bernie, frankly, was more entertaining than Hillary. They had their thumb on the scale, and they ended up with the candidate that they certainly ended up with the Republican candidate they wanted. They just didn't end up with the president that they wanted. They were too clever by half.
Indeed. And, you know, when you think, too, about the situation where now you have Donald Trump as president of the United States and a big part of the Republican base very devoted to him and very loyal to him. Again, the Democratic Party, by focusing as they have so much on the Russia collusion story, it seems to me that that's just going to be a losing. I mean, everybody says, Trump is so unpopular now, the Democrats will regain the House of Representatives in 2018. I don't think so. I mean, I stopped making predictions after November 8th last year. But it seems to me that the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party elites don't have a clue as to how to really reach the masses of people in the United States who are genuinely hurting.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, there's a messaging problem. Who could tell you what the Democrats would do if they were to somehow control the White House and both houses of Congress again? Nobody knows because they don't message. They're not messaging anything. And then at the same time, there's still a war between the Bernie and the Hillary wings of the party, and that has not been resolved, and it doesn't look like it's going to get resolved anytime soon. So if the election 2016 were held all over again, I bet you'd get very similar results all over again, or certainly not radically different. There might be some Republicans who are anti-Trump, but I don't know that they would show up for Hillary. And then you've got a Democratic Party that just seems congenitally unable to set up an alternate narrative. And I think that's probably in the end going to be it. I think that the Russia stuff is, again, it just makes the Democrats look foolish because there's still zero evidence to support any of it.
The Democrats were also sleeping when the Republicans, as a matter of focus after Obama was elected, gerrymandered all the congressional seating in any state where they could, so much so that even in many of those sort of battleground states where the aggregate number of voters for House votes in the state go to Democrats, the Republicans still control it. They still control the state house. They control a big part of the country. Ted Wall, we have about 2 minutes left, a little bit less. I want to turn to a different subject real quick. Speaking last night in Phoenix about the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, which is currently being renegotiated, Trump said these words: "Personally, I don't think we can make a deal. I think we'll end up probably terminating NAFTA at some point." Is that just for leverage in the negotiations, or do you think Trump is ready to walk away from NAFTA?
I actually think he's going to break this promise. I think that, which, by the way, is one I wish he would keep. I don't think that NAFTA's been good for America, for American jobs. I don't think, for that matter, it's been good for Mexican workers either. A lot of people who work in the filthy maquiladoras could tell you along the border. But I think that in the end, finance capital will not allow NAFTA, which is such a core, along with the WTO, really cornerstone of the globalization of the 21st century globalization of transnational business. I don't think they will let that go. It's very much analogous to Trump's recent decision to break his campaign promise about withdrawing from Afghanistan. The generals and the corporations just wouldn't let him walk away from this war. There's just too much money in it. There's just too much money in not NAFTA necessarily itself, although certainly it's lucrative, but in the idea of globalization. If NAFTA goes, then other things can go too. Other trade deals can go, and then it's one thing after another, and that could be the beginning of the end for these for these sweetheart deals for corporations. So my prediction is that there will be no change, and that NAFTA will continue pretty much as it has been.
Yeah, I agree with you. No government can really walk away from or oppose the economic ruling class that it's supposed to serve. And that economic ruling class is in love with NAFTA. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He's the award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Angela Merkel is publicly distancing herself from Donald Trump's ultra-aggressive position on North Korea. Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian companies have been sanctioned by the United States for their alleged business ties to North Korea. This is after Russia and China voted with the United States at the United Nations for new harsh sanctions on North Korea. We are joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Brian.
Thank you for joining. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said today in an interview with the Handelsblatt newspaper, "I do not believe that all diplomatic means have been exhausted. We can and should do more than that." And that Germany would, quote, "not automatically follow the U.S. president into a conflict with the DPRK. Well, just what do you make of her comments?
Well, I think that they are a first sign from a very important country, that which is Germany, which is the key ally of the United States in Europe and in NATO, that not everybody is in agreement with U.S. policy towards North Korea. Now, the Germans have been signaling this for some time. Sigmar Gabriel, who is Germany's foreign minister, made similar comments a few days ago. But this is Angela Merkel herself. She is Germany's chancellor. She's Germany's leader. Germany's having elections at the moment, parliamentary elections. Merkel is, however, still expected to win them and to continue to be chancellor. So we see that there is now a political consensus emerging in Germany that U.S. policy towards North Korea is excessively confrontational, and that the United States should seek diplomatic solutions rather than military ones. And that really rather points to the United States following the sort of proposals which have been made by China and, to a lesser extent, by Russia for a diplomatic solution of the conflict.
We're speaking with Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. We're speaking to Alexander from London. Speaking of diplomacy and what the U.S. will do, the U.S. government seems to be speaking with different voices. I mean, it is speaking with different voices. Maybe it's hard cop, soft cop, you know, the way once in interrogation, some cop pretends to be your friend, the other one pretends or suggests they're going to beat you unconscious unless you cooperate. In other words, it's possible it's all just a big tactic, or it's possible that there are differences of opinion, or it's possible that some people who aren't favoring an ultra-aggressive position are trying to say things publicly so that the situation between the U.S. and North Korea doesn't get out of hand. Let's listen to Rex Tillerson speaking yesterday about the possibility of a de-escalation in Korea. From Germany to the State Department, the more traditional, quote, responsible managers of the American empire seem to be trying to, I would say, cool the situation that may have been recklessly inflamed by Donald Trump's rhetoric. Let's listen to Rex Tillerson.
I'm pleased to see that the regime in Pyongyang has certainly demonstrated some level of restraint that we've not seen in the past. We hope that this is the beginning of this signal that we've been looking for, that they are ready to restrain their level of tensions, they're ready to restrain their provocative acts, and that perhaps we are seeing our pathway to sometime in the near future having some dialogue.
Okay, your reaction, Alexander.
Well, I think the first thing to say is, going back to the comment you made, that there's never been much coherence in U.S. foreign policy, with different parts of the bureaucracy, frequently pointing in and speaking in different directions, but that situation has never been anywhere near as bad as it has been over the last few months since Donald Trump was inaugurated. So on the one hand, it is quite clear that the United States has no realistic option but to talk to North Korea. It's not just, of course, Secretary Tillerson who has been speaking in this way. He has been actually for some time the primary advocate of dialogue on the part of the United States towards solving this problem. But even President Trump has talked about a mutual respect between himself and Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader. And, of course, we've now seen the Germans talking about the need for a diplomatic solution. And at the same time, we also have the U.S. Treasury imposing sanctions on China and Russia, which have been trying to help facilitate precisely that diplomatic solution that everybody talks about being necessary. So we are seeing completely different voices. And this is always the problem everybody has dealing with the United States, because the system there, the governmental system, the bureaucracy, seems almost conditioned now to look for confrontation wherever it can. It never seems to be able to focus entirely on pursuing compromise. And the result is that he's never able to execute these policies very efficiently. Now, if I can just say something else, if we go back to what Secretary Tillerson said, he spoke about the North Koreans showing restraint. It's difficult to know exactly what he's referring to. The North Koreans have not carried out the kind of military demonstration that some of them were talking about, of shooting missiles towards Guam, where the U.S. has a major base. But I don't think many people really ever took that very seriously. They're continuing to launch their missiles. They're continuing to press ahead with their various nuclear weapons programs. So it's not as if the North Koreans are actually changing their policies very radically. It seems that there are some people in the United States who realize that the United States has no alternative but to talk to North Korea. And as you said, U.S. allies say now that the U.S. has no realistic alternative but to talk to North Korea. But there are other people, as we've seen in Washington, who are simply not getting that message.
Yeah, and I think there may be some parts of the U.S. establishment. I could be, of course, wrong, but it seems to me that there are certain voices that feel war with North Korea ultimately will happen, and that it's better to strike now and fight now when North Korea has a limited nuclear arsenal, a limited missile technology. You know, it was a little bit the same in the 1950s when China got the nuclear weapons. It was, you know, there was a big chorus in the United States that this was inconceivable. The U.S. could never live with a nuclear-armed China, and that war was coming, and let's just start it and get it over with before the Chinese get an ample number of weapons. In other words, real madness, like let's have a nuclear war because we can win. And then other voices tempered that. And ultimately, not only did the United States accept China as a nuclear power, but the United States developed bilateral relations with China, as we know, in the 1970s.
I'm very glad you brought up the question of China, actually, because, of course, if you look at U.S. rhetoric about China in the 1950s and 1960s, the U.S. in those days spoke about China in ways that are not very different from the ways they talk about North Korea now. At that time, China was seen as an extreme totalitarian state, spoken about in the most paranoid way. And, of course, it should be said that some of the rhetoric that came out of China at that time was such that it could be used to reinforce that. China in those days, for example, talked about the inevitability of nuclear war. And yet, eventually, as you correctly say, wiser counsels prevailed, and the United States not only eventually mended fences with China in the 1970s, for a brief period, it even forged what almost amounted to a de facto alliance with that very China against the Soviet Union. Now, if the United States could come to some kind of a rapprochement with China along those sort of lines, there is no objective reason why it cannot do so with North Korea, which has no interest in attacking the United States. Were it to attack the United States, it would guarantee its own destruction. And I don't think anybody who has examined this situation objectively thinks that's what the North Koreans want to do. So just as one should put aside the rhetoric about North Korea, as was done previously about China, and talk to North Korea, so I think an attempt to achieve a dialogue with North Korea might in time be as effective as pursuing a dialogue with China once was. But of course, we come back to something else, which is that, of course, North Korea is a less powerful country than China. It's a very small country by comparison to China. And you're absolutely right in saying that there are people in the United States who's talked quite freely, actually, about the need for a war with North Korea. And some of the things that Senator Lindsey Graham, for example, has been saying basically amount to let's get this over with as soon as possible, whilst any damage is limited to the Korean Peninsula and possibly to Japan. Because at the moment, if we have a war in the Korean Peninsula, it won't extend to the United States. Utterly reckless and irresponsible language, actually terrifying language, and one hopes it isn't followed through.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham, let's start the war because it'll just be Asians dying, and we're Americans. And he basically said, you know, President Trump is the president of the United States. He doesn't have to worry about people dying in Asia because he's not the president over there. He's the president here. I mean, it really reckless, immoral, disgusting. I mean, all of those things. You know, one thing that it seems to me, Alexander, based on my own, I've been to DPRK numerous times. I've followed the issue carefully for a long time. It seems to me because the DPRK, North Korea, has been independent of the Soviet Union, was independent of Russia after the Soviet Union, has been independent of China, is a fully sovereign country. It doesn't have foreign forces on its soil. It also, you know, I could see actually if the United States had a friendly policy towards the DPRK, I could see the DPRK ultimately, even though this would blow most people's minds, the DPRK's foreign policy being more oriented towards the United States, say, than to China or to Russia. I could actually see that happening, but that would require the United States government to think the United States government wants to do that. And also, I think a lot of people still believe that this little tiny country should have been overthrown following the fall of the Soviet Union. The U.S. should still be able to undo it. In other words, it's a matter of imperial hubris and pride to be able to crush them. And that's partly, it's sort of like this ideological sort of focused approach of negativity towards the DPRK. I mean, the DPRK's military budget is smaller than the New York City Police Department budget, so they're obviously not looking for a war with the United States. Anyway, let me ask you a different question. The U.S., I want to go back to the sanctions issue, because here you have Russia and China joining the United States and sanctioning the North Koreans, and then the United States sanctioning China and Russia for doing any trade with North Korea. The U.S. Treasury on Tuesday, as you mentioned, slapped sanctions on Chinese and Russian companies deemed to be, quote, in support of the North Korean regime. China's foreign ministry, and I think the Russian foreign ministry, is angry, is denouncing this and calling these sanctions illegal.
Well, I think the short answer is that they are. I mean, they're not just illegal because, of course, there is actually no international legal framework for them happening. But they're completely arbitrary because the companies that are involved have no mechanism to challenge them. I read a lengthy account given by the CEO of the Russian company that's been sanctioned, And he said that what actually happened was that his company had some contacts with North Korea 5 years ago. These contacts never crystallized into anything definite. There was never any actual trade or any dealings of any kind. But it seems that that's enough to get one sanctioned. And there is no mechanism to appeal it. There's nothing they can say to the United States that would change that. So, of course, it's illegal. And the Russians and the Chinese must feel extremely angry, and they must also feel, and not for the first time, that they have been taken advantage of, that they went to great lengths to support the United States in the Security Council, that they passed a resolution in the Security Council for sanctions against North Korea. They do not feel threatened by North Korea, but nonetheless, they help the United States with this, and their reward is to have more sanctions, more illegal sanctions, slapped on them. And some people in Moscow and some people in Beijing must be asking, what is the point of going to the United Nations and helping the United States in this way if the only result is that the United States just goes on imposing sanctions upon us, which may, of course, make it more difficult going down the line for a consensus to be reached on taking action of this sort in future. So it is wrong, it is illegal, and it is also counterproductive. Can I also very quickly say that I am completely in agreement with you that North Korea, being a proudly independent country, whatever else North Korea is, it is that. I think it would welcome a relationship with the United States, because relations between North Korea and China have always had an element of stress between them. So I think that the North Koreans would be very pleased to have a strong relationship with an outside power like the United States, which would help them to maintain a distance from China. And I think if the Trump administration wanted to do anything good in this world, Donald Trump going to Pyongyang might be almost as dramatic and as beneficial in some ways as Richard Nixon going to Beijing. Whether it will ever happen, I don't know.
It's a really interesting situation. I have to say, I wonder about the Russian and Chinese government's decision to keep sort of appeasing the United States by going along with these harsh sanctions against the DPRK. They obviously don't want the DPRK or the Korean Peninsula to be nuclear. That's their genuine position of Russia and China. But you're right. They don't feel threatened. It's the United States, and they're helping the United States. And so they help the United States. They alienate DPRK, obviously, these are harsh sanctions that have been imposed on DPRK. But the U.S. turns around and then just sanctions China and Russia back. It's like you can't, in a way, appease this beast. I mean, the beast says when you make a concession to it, oh, thank you very much. Now, what else will you give me, or what else can I take from you? I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but what's your opinion?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that is exactly what the problem is. It comes back to what we were saying before. And I think, Ryan, we've come across this again and again in our various discussions about many international issues, about the conflict in Syria, about the conflicts in Iraq, about all sorts of other matters. You come to an agreement with the United States. This is how the Russians and the Chinese must increasingly see it. And what you get is that the United States pockets whatever concession you give them, and it comes back and asks for more. And it never really seems to shift in its own demands. Now, the thing I would say about this is that, of course, the Chinese are the people who are leading the diplomatic position as between China and Russia in the Korean conflict. And I think they've had rather less experience of having to deal with the United States than Russia has done in places like Syria and Ukraine. So I think they're perhaps rather further behind on the learning curve on something like this than the Russians are.
Okay, Alexander, we're sadly, we are completely out of time. We've been joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He's the editor-in-chief of the Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us in the Washington, D.C. area every day, Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. at 105.5 FM. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.